envío gratis.
Curso intensivo para el First Exam, el programa de Vaughan para superar el examen oficial de Cambridge y obtener el First Certificate, B2. Para más información, grupovaughan.com.
You're listening.
Esto lo que oyes.
To Vaughan Radio. You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
Gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughan Radio. Now, let me begin by telling you about a book that I read a long time ago. This book is from 1997. The author is Jared Diamond. The book is called Guns, Germs, and Steel. Now, the book begins with this premise. The author, who is an anthropologist, who studies so-called primitive people, he spent a lot of time in New Guinea, and one of those moments in New Guinea, he has a friend there, speaking to the friend simply asks him why it is that he, Jared Diamond, the anthropologist, representative of European culture, why it is that he has this superior technology. Why it is that he is able to come to New Guinea, and it isn't the people there in New Guinea that discovered this superior technology and are able to go all over the world investigating the rest of us. Why Europe? And the question began to intrigue Jared Diamond, and he began to think about, obviously it wasn't any question of intelligence, wasn't any question of racial superiority or inferiority of any kind. What would it have been, for example, the Neolithic revolution, transformation from the Paleolithic, from hunter-gatherers, recolectores, no, cazadores, recolectores, hunter-gatherers, into sedentary people, raising crops, cultivos, with agriculture and with domesticated animals. All of this happening in the Fertile Crescent about 5,000 years ago, although modern archaeology has complicated this, but essentially it's that. It's a transition in the Fertile Crescent, Mesopotamia, the Nile Valley, roughly 5,000 years ago, that spread. It began to spread little by little. It spread over the Mediterranean. It arrived in the Iberian Peninsula through the Mediterranean and then out through into the Atlantic and the other side of the Iberian Peninsula in just a question of generations. You've got sedentary people bringing their new discovery, agriculture, to the west of the Mediterranean, and all of that spreads gradually. All of this we know. But he is talking about what makes civilization possible. One of the things that makes civilization possible is the fact that you are not dependent on this this rise and fall of populations, along with the rise and fall of the la cosecha, no, of harvests, this Malthusian lifestyle where if you have a bad harvest, then all of a sudden many, many people die. No, the creation of civilization is the capacity to store amathenar, store grain or store something, store usable food from one year to the next. And although, for example, in a place like Papua New Guinea, archaeologists indicate that they were cultivating the cassava melon, that they had already made the transition from hunter-gatherers into the Neolithic sort of agriculture. They had already done this millennia earlier than in the Fertile Crescent. The fact is that the cassava cannot be kept from one year to the next. There is no way to preserve the cassava. And so, in a bad year, people die. In a good year, you have a population boom, but in a bad year, people die of hunger. People starve. Now, in Gun, Germs, and Steel, Jared Diamond talks about the unique advantages of, first, the grains that were available for domestication, that were available for the first agriculturalists in the Neolithic, and the advantages of these, primitive wheat, right, trigo, there was barley, cebada, and all sorts of others, and the number of crops that were domesticated increased, and these can be stored from one year to the next. And so the earliest cities were precisely this. Usually you had a group of priests, a royal family that is somehow connected to the gods, and the priests who are there to administer pretty much everything belonging to the royal family. And then you have the common people who live from agriculture and surrender part of their crops, cultivos, part of their crops, to the priests, and so on and so on. All of this done with irrigation in what Max Weber, what the German sociologist called a hydraulic despotism, at least in the beginning, because on rivers, the Mesopotamia, the Tigris, the Euphrates, and then in China, the Yellow River and the Yangtze. Then, of course, the Ganges, the Irrawaddy, many of these rivers in Asia, these rivers which, by the way, still account for the bulk of population on this planet, all of these rivers that form up in the Himalayas, their headwaters, right, the El Nacimiento, Los Grandes Ríos, the headwaters, like, for example, the Mekong River, all of these converge. The Brahmaputra, for example, all of them converge up in the highlands of the Himalayas. And they are still responsible for the bulk of the world's population. Why? Because these people have rice. Rice cultivation needs, to be really effective, really productive, rice cultivation needs a very high degree of cooperation. And with rice, you can have population densities of up to 3,000 people per square kilometer. I'm talking about in a rural community, if you can imagine this. I mean, outside of that, you get Siberia with 2 people per square kilometer. Actually, there are parts of Spain where the population density is also 2 people per square kilometer. But again, no cultivation of rice. Now, by this logic, by the way, these the food that forms the main mass of carbohydrates, mostly carbohydrates for people, this is called the staple crop. You remember well. Staple is also grappa. The two words really don't have anything to do with each other, but the staple crop, for example, the typical staple crop in the Mediterranean was and has always been wheat, trigo. Now, rice is also a staple crop. And in Africa, in areas that are too humid for either of these or for barley, for example, cebada, you can have millet, mijo, as a staple crop. Now, the disadvantage in the Americas, in Peru, you had a large number of potatoes. In the Andes, you could grow potatoes. I believe they have something like 68 different kinds of potatoes that they use on a regular basis. The rest of the world uses a very small number of potatoes. But in the Andes, originally, you had an enormous number of potatoes in use. And those potatoes, which would normally rot, right, pudrir, to rot. Those potatoes would normally rot under normal conditions. But because of the orography, because of the different heights of parts of the geography of parts of the Andes, the proximity of the Andes, because the terrain is so accidentado, right? Because it's so uneven. It is possible to take those potatoes up into the mountains where they can be kept dry from one year to the next. And so in years of hambruna, of famine, you can bring those potatoes down and people will survive. So yes, Inca civilization was possible. Now, the difficult part was making corn cultivable, transforming corn, a kind of a grass, corn maíz. We can say maize in English. The word corn in English originally meant cereal. It was a synonym for cereal, like the German Kern. But this corn, when the English began to colonize North America and discovered corn from the Indians there, the corn that they used, it became synonymous with cereal. And so they simply used the word corn for this, for maíz, whereas in Britain, they still distinguished between corn, any kind of cereal, and maize. However, over the years, corn is used more and more frequently for maíz. You get popcorn, for example, palomitas, or you get corn flakes, copos de maíz. Corn is sort of taking over to mean maíz in general. Now, originally, corn was like a grass. Corn was the little kernels, right? The little seeds on the ear of corn, the mazorca. They were very, very small. And it took generations of human intervention, generations of cultivation, generations of deliberate genetic modification, so that as a result, the corn today, for example, is sterile. It cannot reproduce naturally. You need human intervention for that corn to exist. Well, this happened over a very, very long period of time. It was a very difficult process. And so, again, this staple, the use of staple in North America, the use of corn, was actually only practicable for a relatively short period of time. A shorter period of time than, for example, in the case of rice or wheat. In any case, people's experiments with plants between, say, 9,000 BC and 3,000 BC, the early experiments, you know, because you did have things, the first production of wine, for example, fermentation of fruit juices, of honey, all of these things, yes, archaeology tells us that these are long, they precede the Neolithic transformation by millennia. The fact is that since then, really no basic food plants have been domesticated. During the Roman Empire, you had things coming from far away that were instituted, things like asparagus or cherries or apricots, things that came from relatively far away that were imported into Europe and spread because of the empire. Then you had the Pax Arabica during the time when the Arabs controlled the trade routes for a large part of the globe. And you had rice and palm trees, dates, right? Dátiles. And you had saffron, azafrán. You had many things coming into Spain, sugar, for example, coming into Spain that way because of the Pax Arabica, because of this extensive intercontinental maritime trade network. But those things didn't originate at that time. Those things simply, they were spread. They were extended at that time. Really, the only exceptions are things that were found in the modern age, the age of exploration, in North America. And things that, for example, for many people, really wouldn't make a difference. In Spain, for example, la nuez pecana. Pecana, for most people don't know what that is. It's very popular in North America. And in the United States, it is used with relative frequency in cooking. It's a nut like walnuts, nueces, or a little sweeter. And you could compare it, I don't know, maybe to a pistachio. In any case, pecans, and then, of course, blueberries, el arándano azul, the, you know, when you talk about frutas del bosque, that includes strawberries and raspberries, frambuesas, and el arándano azul, blueberries. All of these were originally found in North America. Also, the cranberry. Cranberry, arándano rojo. I mean, a lot of people don't distinguish between el arándano azul y el rojo, but they're very different. They're completely different. Probably because they came to Spain at the same time from the same place. And never figured highly in the cuisine here. Certainly they aren't traditional. You would get them in ultramarino or something like that, colmado. You would find them in shops for, you know, the exotic shops. Well, these things, all from North America, gathered by native North Americans, but not normally domesticated. These are the only exceptions. They have been domesticated in the last two centuries. Other than that, nothing. Now, there are something like 200,000 different kinds of plants with flower and fruit, but only about 3,000 of those have ever really been used as human food. And of those, only about 15 are of any importance. Now, wheat, rice, corn, and sugar are four kinds of grasses. And they represent something very, very important in terms of global feeding, global food supply. Of the legumes, or pulses, as the British would say, lentils, peas, guisantes, no? Beans, soybeans, and peanuts, all of those would count as being the real important ones. And the almidones, tubercules, right? Potatoes, the sweet potato, batata, not the patata, but the batata, yams, and bananas, of course, manioca. And these things would be used heavily by human beings as staples. Remember that it's very difficult to translate the word staple as being the fundamental food supply for a people, a primarily agricultural people. But yes, all of these 15 different plants have meant the survival, the life or death of mankind. Now, when it came time to explore the New World, it was going to be necessary to practice a completely different kind of agriculture to replace the subsistence agriculture with a new kind, with plantation agriculture. Agriculture primarily for export. A very labor-intensive agriculture that was going to need slavery or something similar to slavery in order to cultivate it. Now, in the process of Columbian exchange in what came from the New World to the Old. For example, the tomato, the pepper, the potato, chocolate. Well, a lot of that was not going to be useful, for export. Sugar was an exception. And these great sugar plantations, they started almost immediately. Christopher Columbus's brother began. Columbus's wife's family had interest in sugar plantations in Madeira on the island. But all of this wasn't going to help North America. North America, Virginia decided to specialize in tobacco. And the tobacco plantations marked the beginning of what would later be the United States. I'm going to talk about that after my break.
Pásame...
The white coat.
Eso, oye, Frank, pásame...
Eso es un Bunsen burner.
¡Que está encendido!
Ya verás la que lían estos trastos. Estamos preparando todo para tener listo el próximo Science Weekend Camp, donde tus hijos se divertirán a la vez que aprenderán mucho, mucho, mucho inglés, sin darse cuenta. Y tranquilos, el único peligro son estos tres, y se quedan en casa. Las plazas vuelan, así que llama ya al 91-133-5832 o campamentosbaugan.com 91-133-5832.
Os esperamos a todos en el Science Weekend Camp.
¿No quieres aprender inglés? ¿No quieres conocer expresiones y vocabulario? Ah, entonces no nos busques, porque con nuestros trimestrales mejorarás tu agilidad oral y nivel auditivo y reforzarás la gramática en grupos reducidos y mediante el método Vaughan. Aprenderás inglés. Así que no nos llames al 91-133-5833, 91-133-5833, ni nos visites en grupovaughan.com.
Dicen que la mejor forma de aprender un idioma es... llevártelo a la cama. En Vaughan pensamos en todo. Queremos que todo el mundo encuentre su motivación para aprender inglés y no queremos que nadie se quede solo este San Valentín. Por eso tenemos un libro que se llama Inglés para ligar y todo lo que viene después. No tenemos que explicarte de qué va, ¿verdad? En Inglés para ligar y todo lo que viene después encontrarás todo el inglés que necesitas para encontrar el amor o lo que sea que estés buscando. Consigue Inglés para ligar y todo lo que viene después ahora mismo por solo 16,95. Inglés para ligar y todo lo que viene después. Encuéntralo en vaughantienda.com.
I'm 100% Spanish. I began learning English when I was about 10. And I just fell in love with it, with language. I can't remember a time when I didn't speak English. And that's what I like about it so much.
Be like Elena. Be like them. I like it.
Descubre más en grupovaughan.com.
¿Y a ti? ¿Se te hace cuesta arriba el inglés? Clases 100% método Vaughan para todos los niveles que te darán el empujón que necesitas para vencer todas tus dificultades con el idioma. Más información en el 91-133-5833 o en grupovaughan.com.
Beat, beat, beaten. Come, came, come. Drive, drove, driven.
Para. ¿Tú te crees que así vas a aprender gramática? Ya te lo decimos nosotros. No. Para aprender gramática necesitas dos cosas, teoría y práctica. Por eso lanzamos nuestro pack de gramática fácil y gramática fácil ejercicios. Un pack de dos libros esenciales para comprender y trabajar la gramática del inglés, con explicaciones sencillas para que todo te quede muy clarito y ejercicios dinámicos y entretenidos basados en el método Vaughan, desde nivel 0 a nivel nativo. Si estás buscando materiales realmente útiles para pulir tus errores gramaticales, aquí los tienes. Pack Gramática Fácil y Gramática Fácil Ejercicios. Consíguelos ya en vaughantienda.com.
Curso intensivo para el First Exam, el programa de Vaughan para superar el examen oficial de Cambridge y obtener el First Certificate, B2. Para más información, grupovaughan.com.
Es el momento de descubrir las claves del éxito. De la mano de Richard Vaughan y Javier Fernández Aguado. No te quedes sin tu plaza para el seminario Emprender y Liderar. Las claves del éxito. El próximo martes 29 de enero, de 16:30 a 20:30 horas, en la oficina central de Vaughan, en la calle Orense 69, primera planta. Entra en grupovaughan.com/seminario. Ahora es tu momento.
¿Estás escuchando?
Hola, ¿qué tal?
Esto, lo que oyes.
Vaughan Radio.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on the first part of the program, I was speaking about different crops, different cultivos, back from the time of the Neolithic Revolution. These staples, that means agricultural people, in people living directly from the land, these are the crops that represent most of their food, especially the carbohydrates. Staples like, wheat or rice. Wheat, trigo, rice, corn, maíz, potatoes. Now, the things that were going to be necessary in the New World, and especially in North America, well, it couldn't be this traditional agriculture. It would have to be, again, specifically for exports. And let's say the history of the English colonies in North America begins with the history of tobacco. Tobacco from the Americas. Tobacco part of what we call the Columbian Exchange, going from the New World to the Old. Now, among the natives there, among the indigenous peoples, you had an extensive ritual use for tobacco in ceremonies, in all sorts of things, agreements, deals, celebrations, religious rituals, sacred rituals. There was something special about it. On the other hand, it was only really used on these ceremonial occasions. And as a result, there was absolutely no question of abuse, overuse. It was not considered a recreational drug. That happened once it came to Europe. It happened immediately after it came to Europe. By the way, today, people don't know what to do with it because, of course, the number of smokers, the use of tobacco is decreasing. I was in Cuba recently, and in Cuba, because they are dependent on tobacco exports, they're looking around for other potential uses for tobacco. They've come on a cosmetic use. Tobacco as perfume, tobacco as cologne, tobacco. They've got to think outside the box. But yes, traditionally, ritual uses and medicinal uses. When it arrived in Europe, it was considered a panacea. It was considered a cure-all. They talked about all kinds of medical conditions that responded well to tobacco. Now, among the indigenous people, do you still have this ritual use in as gifts? The idea of the peace pipe, that's actually authentic. There is a peace pipe, and these pipes, the creation of pipes, the carving, right? Tallar, to carve. The carving of pipes, things like that. That can be a very special thing. Of the plants, you know, in the Colombian exchange, the ones I talked about, chocolate, tomato, potato, corn, and tobacco. Well, tobacco was the most successful because tobacco is the only one used in every country all over the world. Now, Las Casas, Palabra Las Casas, talked about what was happening when Columbus first discovered this. He said that he saw men with wood in their hands take certain herbs, dry herbs, put it in a leaf, also dry, and light part of it. The other part they suck, right? Chupar, or they inhale so that they receive smoke inside. And they become almost drunk. It is said that they do not feel fatigue. They call it tobacco. Said there were Spaniards on the island of Española who were accustomed to take it. And when they were admonished, when they were reprimanded, when they were told that it was a vice, they replied that they could not stop. That Las Casas comments that he does not have any idea what enjoyment or what benefit they found in it. And of course, after that, it began to be imported, and little by little. Remember that in the case of England, they began this exploration of North America about 100 years after Spain. So Spain had pretty much 100 years to get used to tobacco before the British decided to go after it in a big way. Following the arrival, again, after about a generation, in the 16th century, the 1530s, there was a tobacco shop, believe it or not, a tobacco shop in Lisbon. And this is the first recorded. Now, the French ambassador to Lisbon at that time in Portugal, a man named Nico, sent tobacco to Paris in 1559. Nico sent leaves and seeds to his king, Francis I. And the mother of Francis I, Catherine of Medici, she was the one who came from Florence, and she brought Florentine, well, the Tuscan understanding of cuisine, You know, the fresh food, the good ingredients, all of that brought to France, and she was one who pretty much created the culinary traditions in France, brought them over from Florence, and implanted them in France. Well, it's going to be Francis and his mother, Catherine of Medici, who use this. And, of course, not the way the natives did, not by lighting it, not by creating smoke, the way that, for example, the Spaniards were doing. The French began to use it as râpe. The name râpe, that name is French. Râpe, it means rayado, right? It means cut in French. Now, in English, we call that snuff. Snuff, obviously, close to sniff, the Dutch word snoefen, that's to sniff. And it's very curious. We use it for two words. Obviously, both of these coming from Dutch. Snuff, at least originally, was a synonym for to sniff. But snuff was also to extinguish a candle by putting something over it that sort of suffocates it, right? It deprives the candle of oxygen. And of course, without oxygen, there is no flame. And so there really is no equivalent in Spanish, but you do talk about despabilar, right? The pavesa, the pabilo of the candle, the burnt wick, the moco of the candle, is cut off. You have a tool for that, actually, the despabiladora. That's to snuff in English. And these two words do not have really anything to do with each other, but they both come from Dutch, Hollandaise, no? El idioma. And by the way, snuff quickly became a synonym for to kill someone. And yes, the idea of extinguishing a life the way you can extinguish a candle, simply put it out. That's the idea behind the word snuff, used in movies, used as slang, argot. Snuff. But snuff is also râpe, to put in your nose, or originally the French put it under the tongue or around the las encías, right? The gums. In any case, because Nico had originally sent this and asked the botanists to look at it, they originally called tobacco nicotiana. But this is obviously where we get nicotine. Now, it was enormously successful, again, as snuff in France, originally not smoked. The snuff making you sneeze, this sort of involuntary reaction, was actually, I don't know, according to the French, according to, and the people, of course, in the Baroque times, and then later, especially in the Enlightenment, right, la Ilustración, Snuff was very, very big during the Enlightenment. This sort of involuntary sneeze was, believe it or not, compared to an orgasm. And so there was something something risque, something naughty, right? A pícaro about using snuff, and that made it much, much more attractive. Now, back in 1571, you had a Spanish doctor, Nicolás Monardes, who wrote a book about tobacco and how it would cure problems, all kinds of medical problems. 36 different medical conditions that could be cured with the use of tobacco. Now, in Spain, of course, it was not considered welcome by all. I mean, just a few years later, in the 17th century, you had Quevedo, who was absolutely opposed, appalled, talking about, chocolate on the one hand and tobacco on the other, the devil of tobacco and the devil of chocolate. He said, they have told me that they are capable of avenging the Indies against Spain. So yes, they have done more harm between them in the forms of snuff, of smoke, and of chocolate drinks than Columbus or Cortez or Almagro or Pizarro, all of them together on the other side of the Atlantic. And he said that with tobacco, it causes dizziness, and it causes mocos, it causes sniffling and snorting, and of course chocolate causes gases and dizziness, mareo. And so he goes a little further, saying that these devils are Spain brought Christianity to the New World. Well, the New World is bringing this sort of paganism through the adoration of chocolate and tobacco, the veneration of chocolate and tobacco, back into the Old World. Because, because smoking is like being apprenticed to hell. The fact is that, when Charles II, this is in 1669, when Charles II turned 7 years old, the viceroy of Valencia threw a party, and they had chocolate in jicaras. I don't know of any other country, maybe Portugal, that has jicaras, but the jicara is Spain's great contribution to ceramics, to the form of ceramics. There certainly isn't any other equivalent, anything like the jicara, in any other country that I know of. In any case, they were, and the jicara, again, from the beginning. So yes, fine chocolate served in jicaras, but also tobacco. And, the festivities, talking about chocolate and tobacco, those two things always combined at least in Spain, always combined chocolate, tobacco, chocolate. One of the poetry competitions in this party mentioned that chocolate is manna and tobacco is mania. So yes, that's the difference between the two. Manna and mania. So, in any case, it was relatively welcome, Quevedo aside, relatively welcome in Spain, whereas, well, at the beginning, in Elizabethan times, they had started with the first plantations, and in Virginia, it was going to be necessary for plantation cultivation to happen. Now, the following king, the first of the Stuarts, James the First, he hated the idea of tobacco, and he wrote a terrible criticism of it called The Counterblast to Tobacco. He wrote it in the year 1604. He said that this is a custom which is loathsome to the eye, right? Atroz, hateful to the nose, harmful, dañino, to the brain, dangerous to the lungs. The black stink thereof, resembling the horrible Stygian smoke of the pit that is bottomless, the idea of comparing it to hell. Now, he published this anonymously, and so absolutely nobody paid any attention to it. Then he got offended and published it again in his own name, so that people had to pay attention, although, well, not a lot was done. And yes, they put a tax on it. The tax increased the price of tobacco by 4,000%. So the cost went up 40 times what it had been. But demand remained the same, even with this high price. They say that at this time there were 7,000 different shops in London that sold tobacco. And so what they did was to create a royal monopoly. In other words, it was going to be far too lucrative. On an earlier program, I talked about the Bourbon reforms, right, under José Gálvez, trying to get more revenue, trying to modernize the colonial administration and derive more money, more revenue from the New World, from New Spain, Peru, and of course they created New Granada and the intendancies of Río de la Plata, for example, of different administrative zones that were easier to control. Now, this involved the creation of a tobacco monopoly as well, but they were following in the footsteps of James the First of England, because the first Bourbon monopoly, this was done with the arrival of the Bourbon kings, with Felipe Quinto, and that was done in 1717, whereas this is way back in 1624, the royal monopoly. No tobacco could be imported except from Virginia. The license to import cost £15 per year, and tobacco cultivation in England was prohibited. The thing is that this went a long way toward promoting Virginia and creating Virginia as a destination and making Virginia 100% dependent on tobacco. And that was, when you talk about Virginia, at least in early colonial days, you have to talk about tobacco. That was pretty much all there was. Now, I'm going to have to continue this on my next program, but I am going to begin to compare and contrast how the English did it and how the Spanish did it in the 18th century. And again, the creation of the estancos, the creation of the tabacalera, the creation of these enormous factories in the Spanish Empire, something that did not have an equivalent in England. But I've run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please listen to my next program.
Es el momento de descubrir las claves del éxito. De la mano de Richard Vaughan y Javier Fernández Aguado. No te quedes sin tu plaza para el seminario Emprender y Liderar. Las claves del éxito. El próximo martes 29 de enero de 16:30 a 20:30 horas en la oficina central de Vaughan en la calle Orense 69, primera planta. Entra en grupovaughan.com/seminario. Ahora es tu momento. Estás escuchando.
You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
Listening. Vaughan Radio.
Vaughan Radio.
¿Cuál de estas palabras no tienen un equivalente de una sola palabra en inglés? A. Planchar. B. Descambiar. O C. Estrenar.